Thank you very much. I was going to let you go till 8 o'clock, which on my watch is 2 minutes later. We're not going to have very long for discussion with the platform directly for a very simple reason. Not to close down discussion, but because we have to be out of this building by 9 o'clock, totally out, and this is also a book launch, and we hope that people will buy the book, stop around, talk to people, including talking to David and to Richard and to each other. So that's the reason for a fairly brief discussion. Secondly, I'm going to invite questions and contributions from the floor, but I'm going to preface it with a very simple request. I was brought up proud of that aspect of being Jewish which said, three Jews, four opinions. Apart from anything else, it was my family, and it was actually five or six opinions. I thought that was a wonderful thing about being Jewish. I rejoice in it. And I'm going to say to anybody who feels that they are going to ask or say something controversial or challenging, you are welcome. But please do so in a way that is brief, because there's a lot of people here, and constructive. The last meeting I was at, somebody asked a hostile question, which I thought was perfectly valid, and I never got an answer because the room erupted, because it was asked in such a nasty way. So please be courteous, please be brief, and I would like people's hands to go up if you've got a question or a contribution to make. Right, I'm going to work backwards, and seven. Now seven is no more than about a minute each. Please, could you start?
I've never been to an anthropology lecture before, but I've just been to an anthropology lecture here. It's fascinating to hear about this particular tribe, but one should not go away with the impression that this is the only tribe within Judaism. In fact, Jewish Policy Research Survey, 82% of mainstream Orthodox Jews consider themselves to be Zionists. So this is really, for those of you who are not Jewish and don't believe, it's a tiny fringe movement on the side. My question to the speaker is, I have really quite a profound objection to your title, Jewish Identity and Palestinian Rights, Diaspora Jewish Opposition to Israel, as if one has to oppose Israel to support Palestinian rights. I assure you there are plenty of people within the Israeli government as well who support both Israel and who support a secure, non-violent Palestinian state. And when are you going to write the book, Jewish Identity and Palestinian Rights, Diaspora Jewish Support for Israel? You're an academic, you're impartial. When's that book going to be written?
I think you're making a couple of good points, actually, which we didn't make. One of the things was, 83% identify as Zionists. Well, I'm a bit, like the latest IJPR survey, I thought was a bit dodgy. I think
a bit
that's
what?
A bit dodgy.
It was done by Maury, it was done by a professional opinion company. Why
did
you say it was dodgy?
Well, actually, I actually put out the reasons in my book, but it's not a major thing, but I think you're pointing out a good point. I'm actually agreeing with you on this particular one, which is, most Jews remain Zionists. Most Jews remain supporters of Israel. This is a minority movement. It's much less of a minority than it was, of course, 5 years ago, or certainly 10 years ago, but it's still a minority movement, without a shadow of a doubt. So, yeah, we agree there. When I'll say diaspora Jewish support of Israel and Palestinian rights, I suppose I'll say that when, Israel treats Palestinians like equal human beings, you know? I mean, we're going to actually have to disagree on this one.
They've been offered a state four times.
We'll have to disagree. Seriously, we'll have to disagree on this one.
Right, number two, please. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Irving Rappaport, and I work in the Parliament for the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Conflict, and I don't have strong views either way. But there's two quick points I'd like to make. From what I've heard so far, David's comment, or question I should say, is the price of identity construction. Is it about ourselves as Jews, or is it about the Palestinians? So far, from this evening's proceedings, I'd say it's about the Jews. In fact, I would ask, why does an organization have to call itself the Jews for Justice for Palestinians? I don't quite understand that, and I would like clarification, because there are many solidarity campaigns that are not associated with either a race or a religion, whichever way you'd like to describe it. So why does it have to be attached to that? And the second question is, I was interested to hear you say, Richard, that JFJFP struggled for the right to be heard within the Jewish community that it wished to influence. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I went to a meeting where another Jew was struggling to be heard by the Jewish community he wished to influence, but he was prevented from so doing, or there was an attempt to prevent him, by members of JFJFP. His name was Gilad Atzmon, and of course, just a moment, he's been accused of being an anti-Semite.
He is.
But of course, those people who are accusing him, and I'm no apologist for him, haven't read the book, where he makes it absolutely clear right at the beginning that he has absolutely no problem with Jews as Jewish religious people. He has absolutely no problem with people who are members of the human race who happen to be born Jewish. The one problem he does have are those human beings who put their Jewishness above every other consideration. That's the message one of the messages I heard that night. So I'd be interested to know why you decided to prevent him from talking.
Okay, I'll answer the first question, because it's a good question and a quite obvious question. Why Jews for Justice for Palestinians? Stress the kind of Jewishness of the group? And to be honest, in one way you say, oh, it's a good question, but in another way, it's a really obvious question. When Palestine Solidarity is being called anti-Semitic as soon as they do anything, when Israel and Jewishness is being identified as the same thing, there is such a clear and obvious political reason, even if you're talking about a small tactical, strategic reason, to say, no, actually, not all Jews support what Israel does. No, there are Jews who support who support justice for Palestinians. I mean, it is a really obvious... Remember, this is a social movement. It's operating in the real political world. It's not operating just as a kind of out of people's head trying to construct identity. And this is the reason why not simply Jews for Justice for Palestine was starting this country, but similar organizations have been sprung up in every other country in the diaspora. Because when you have somebody like Ehud Olmert saying, and the war of Lebanon, this is a war fought, was it by or for the Jews? For all the Jews. By them, I think it's quite obvious why some Jews stand up and say, no. So I really think that this it's a very clear tactical strategic reason for a group like this to set up. And besides that, I mean, it is people who like feel themselves strongly Jewish and say, no, actually, part of my Jewishness is a support of justice, which includes justice for Palestinians. So there is a kind of obvious reason for it. I think I'll let Richard answer the Atzmon question, and let's keep it.
We can't answer the Atzmon question in 30 seconds. I have no doubt personally that Atzmon is a vile anti-Semite. I'm supported in this, interestingly enough, by Mark Gardner of the Community Security Trust, as well as by other people. But it is an issue, you know, there are mounds of writing. We're not going to settle it in 30 seconds, half a quotation of a bit of a sentence about the spirit of Jewishness, which kind of hovers over everything, which can't be identified. It sounds a bit like the protocols. But look, I'm just going to have to pass for now, but I'm very happy if you want to discuss Gilad Atzmon separately.
Number three, please. Yeah, I think it was the woman, sorry.
Solidarity movements in general, and the way in which JFJFP is a solidarity movement.
Could you speak up a little? Sorry.
It's a question regarding solidarity movements in general, and particularly JFJFP as a solidarity movement of Jews for Justice for Palestinians. And my question is basically bringing up the thread that was discussed earlier about how a solidarity movement can reinforcing victimization, subjectivity, and in a sense taking away agency from oppressed people. And my question is basically just a thought with solidarity movements, and as I said, not perhaps only particularly with Jews engaging in solidarity with Palestinians, but all sorts of solidarity movements. If we look at oppressed black people in the South in America, and white people standing up for those black people's rights, would their efforts be better directed criticizing the white establishment rather than sort of speaking with the black people? And my question is basically the same thing with regards to Jews and Palestinians in this situation. Wouldn't Jewish efforts be better spent focusing their discussion within the Jewish community and perhaps criticizing directly Zionist or Israeli organizations?
They haven't been shy of doing that, in fairness. But there has been quite a lot of that done. But I mean, it's a real issue with solidarity movements, because while I think we should kind of critically think about what we're doing when we're doing solidarity, that doesn't mean that it's not needed. Like, the situations of political solidarity are clearly needed. And the example you used was interesting, about white people, because there was the famous Mississippi Freedom Summit in 1964, when white people went down to the southern state, well, to Mississippi, funny enough, in order to kind of help the blacks there organize. And they were doing it for, quite frankly, the same reasons that Jewish groups are set up all over the world, that they were using their ethnicity productively. Because while the white police force were grand about beating up blacks, it didn't look so, and killing blacks, it didn't look so good when they started killing white people. So there was this kind of use of it, which I think is also behind, what? Which is, yeah, we remember Rachel Corrie. How many other people in Gaza do we remember who've been killed by bulldozers? So there is, I wish it weren't the case, you know, that this is needed. But there's no doubt that it is within the current situation needed. But yeah, there is a problem with it. And eventually, when they had organized, I think, enough, the kind of blacks in the mid-60s in the southern states told their white allies, actually, go back home, we don't need you anymore. Go organize your own communities. So maybe, and hopefully, that situation will come. But at the moment, I think there is still a need for this type of solidarity. This is just a
Number four. Sorry, I'm taking people. I'm going to put their hands up immediately. We're going to go in numerical order. Four.
Start with an apology, because I came in late, so I actually don't really know what the JFJP position is vis-a-vis a Palestinian state. But to just a couple of things that I do know, and that Hamas do not recognise the state of Israel in any way, shape, or form. They call for an Islamic Waqf from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. On the other hand, the PA state, yes, we do believe in a two-state solution. However, with the caveat that the numbers vary, sometimes it's 4, 5, 6, I heard 10 million recently, Palestinians have the right of return to pre-67 Israel, and that no citizenship will be granted to any diaspora Palestinian because that abrogates their right to return to pre-67 borders. So my question to the JFJP is this. Short of Israelis, 6 million Israeli Jews actually waking up one morning and deciding to hold a referendum to negate the state of Israel, the only other way that a Palestinian state will be created to involve all of pre-67 Palestinian areas, whatever you like to call it, would be by existential warfare. So, in practical terms, my question is to the JFJP, how do you suppose this Palestinian state will come about, which involves the whole of what Hamas effectively are demanding?
I'm here to discuss a book. think I'll pass on that question for now. Quite happy to discuss the points afterwards, but not as part of this.
I thought you would, because you have no answer.
Excuse me.
Friends,
remember what I said. I think you asked your question perfectly reasonably. I think Richard overstated it to say it's ridiculous. But actually, we are here to have a particular kind of discussion. And it's very frustrating because this building closes early. So I would ask you, you are welcome to come and talk to him. Were you number five?
Yes, I'd like to support the chair. This is a meeting about a book, not about the position in any organization. I want to go back to the Jewish identity part of the title. You've given a perfectly good answer to the question, why did some Jews form groups with the word Jew or Jewish in relation to Palestine, that is partly for instrumental strategic reasons. That's obvious to most of you there. But more profoundly, I want to ask, how did that process help Jews to clarify what the term meant to them, the term Jew or Jewish meant to them? And in particular, how did something about the Palestinian struggle inform their understanding of what it meant to be Jewish?
I'll have a go on that question, which I think has been the most difficult question asked, because I think the reason why this is so difficult, how did the process of, I suppose, being involved in this movement help clarify what being Jewish was? And relating to Palestinians, help clarify what Jewish was. Is that the kind of question?
Yes.
Yeah, because this is a question that was in a way different for every individual. That for some people, it being involved in the movement and saying that they're Jewish, which previously was simply kind of like a nominal thing, got them to think much more about being Jewish and what being Jewish was about. And this is certainly something that Lynn Siegel, for example, talks about, how her own strategic Jewishness turned around to a much more deep kind of consideration of what like a Jewish upbringing, her Jewish background. So it kind of brought her closer to that. To others, it might have meant the same thing. I don't think for individuals, and really it does in a way depend on which individual we're talking about here. For the movement in general, while some people have definitely gone towards the Jewish field in a way, there's much more in a way institutionalization within the Jewish field, which there is at the same time a kind of growing exasperation with how a lot of people in the community see issues of basically, to use Philip Weiss's formulation, a lot of people in the community are progressive except for Palestine, they're kept Jews. And they're kind of wondering, like, what, surely Jewishness should mean something more than this. So, I mean, it is. I mean, when you're talking about individual spiritual stuff, it's different for each individual. I don't know if that answer is satisfactory.
I'll just add something very briefly, Les. One of the early meetings that JFJFB had, which Dave talks about in the book, was a discussion on Jewish identity. 150 people or something like that, then different people talked about what being Jewish meant to them. And I was staggered by the wide range of ways in which people identified as Jewish. We just had this organization, we'd agreed on everything. And when it came to what it was to be Jewish, I felt, in some of the discussions, I felt utterly out on it. My Jewishness was complete. People very, very kind of deeply embroiled in Jewish culture, in synagogue work and stuff like that, for whom Jewishness meant something different from what it meant for me as a secular Jew, who haven't gone to a synagogue apart from a bar mitzvah and a wedding and a funeral for most of my life, since my bar mitzvah, as it happens. And the range of people we were able to encompass was interesting. it was very difficult to maintain and develop that dialogue over time. And that's just one of the things about all these movements. It's hard to generate. We're talking now about almost 10-year period. JFP today is in some ways very different from what it was in 2002-2003. That's the situation in the Middle East is very different. The fact that many of these groups have been able to maintain a continuity of some of their members and recruit others and so on, I think shows that they definitely are connecting with something in what is perceived as Jewishness in the wider community. Because people come even now and are surprised to discover we exist. They haven't heard of us before, and they're very pleased to know about us and can they sign. The community is remarkably fragmented. What people mean by their identification as Zionists with Israel is remarkably kind of fluid. The younger generation is very good. You look at Judas today and their irreverence, and two fingers up to the institutions of the Jewish community. All power to them, because they actually represent. And in the States, it's much more advanced than here. A whole new generation of Jews who do not care a toss about what the elders of the traditional community are about and are trying to fashion a Jewishness for the diaspora. What that will mean and whether it is possible are questions that that generation is going to have to answer. But I think they're asking very different questions from the kinds of questions that people like me who came from the heart of the Jewish community in South Africa and broke entirely with its narrowness and its religiosity and all of that. And it's a completely different world for new, younger Jews whose Judaism is much, much weaker but very deeply felt than the kind of orthodox Judaism with which I was brought up.
Now, let me explain. We're up to number 5. I had 7 people. I'm going to take the last 3. I'll take them all together, then we'll have answers, and then we're going to break so that you can have a look at the books and have some discussion between you. Number 5. Yeah, you're number 5, I think, yeah? So there's a gentleman there with a... Is it? Yeah.
I wanted to raise the issue of your complete dismissal of the prophetic near the beginning of the book. Because you say we're more influenced by modern ideas of... universal human rights, but surely the ancient prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah made a tremendous contribution to the whole concept of universal values. And you called it a racial construct, but I mean the Hebrew prophets influenced the black liberation movements, the liberation theology movements in Latin America. I mean, I know they're a secular group, but you seem to be saying that only the Jews can't invoke the ancient prophets because that would be a racial construct. I'm sure you can't demand for justice and speaking truth to power. That goes right back to the Hebrew prophets. And we call it regressive stereotyping. And I mean, Isaiah and Jeremiah, you know, they're far ahead of anything that anyone's ever achieved. Mm. So, you know, I did object to that.
And Amos is even better.
The sixth person, I think that were you in the glasses. I think you were.
I think it was me.
There it is. All right, but I really am going to have to close the break soon. There it is.
I wanted to get back to the question of victimhood and to say to Richard, you needn't feel so defensive about it, because the whole trajectory of victimhood is that unless victimhood is recognized, is witnessed and recognized, there's no actually overcoming it. I'll give you an example. And incidentally, here I think we need a Palestinian voice, or as many Palestinian voices as possible, to ask them what they feel about whether or not they're being victimized by the movements in the West. But I'll tell you a little story about, I asked Bassam, actually at the Seder, I think, the JFJFP Seder, I was talking to his son about the Nakba, and his son turned around to me and said, "What?" And he really didn't know what the Nakba was. And I said to Bassam, your son, your 17-year-old son doesn't know about the Nakba. And then I remembered how many of my own family from Poland had not talked about the Holocaust. And in fact, this whole victimhood collective identity, narrative and identity, which now stretches across both the peoples, has been very, very repressed and hidden. and there is a good reason for really exploring that in much more greater detail in its full complexity.
Right. I think somebody with glasses has been trying for ages. Sorry. And then that's going to be the final contribution.
Right.
From the
Tony Green's thing. I know this is the age.
Sorry.
Don't worry. Not everyone has heard or misheard. I know this is the age of Jewish self-identity and Jewish identity, but it can often seem like a self-indulgence as well. A few things I want to say, and unfortunately the Victoria line delayed me, so I didn't hear everything.
You're going to be very brief. One point.
I am indeed going to be very brief, but I will choose you some nuggets if you allow me to. I think the difference and the reason why there is some importance to it is because, unlike the struggle against apartheid, people here who want to support the Palestinians have to meet with a fairly vociferous, well-funded and well-argued lobby. That wasn't really the case with South Africa, apart from the right wing of the Tory party. So it is important. If I can give a very brief example, when we got boycott through BDS, through the first trade union in this country, Unison, it was specifically decided that I should speak as someone who was Jewish in a particular position in order to counter the normal accusations that you get if you support the opposition to Zionism and BDS, therefore you're anti-Semitic.
Rubbish.
So Jews do have a role, a critical role to play, but I think the main thing to say about Jewish identity is simply this: it's a movable feast. It's changed many times in the future, and it will change again. There's no such thing as a fixed identity, so as soon as you fix it, it changes. And I think the problem, to take on the Irving Rappaport thing, and I finish here, is simply this: there are some people who've become so horrified at what Israel does in their name as people who are Jews, they actually recoil against their very Jewish identity without realising they're actually falling into a trap that's in the centre.
Thank you very much.
I've been told to be brief, so I'd be kind of happy being brief with wine being over there and everything. So I want to kind of deal with these questions. Well, funny enough, firstly on the issue of Jewish identity, and then secondly on the issue of Palestinian rights. Firstly on the issue of Jewish identity, Deborah raised a really interesting point about the Jewish prophetic and how it's used, and how Jewish prophets are used as, apparently I said, a racial construct. And yeah, I actually totally stand by that. And it's especially, what I said was the progressive stereotype, and I checked it out, it seems especially stark when used by outsiders. And I've seen it. I really have seen it. The example I was giving was Cornel West, a black American writer, who was saying, he was using prophetic Jews in a way of saying good Jews. And I think that's troubling. You know, there's the prophetic Jews, the good Jews, the proper Jews, and then there's the others. And I think that is actually a really troubling way of doing things. So that, of course, Jews can draw upon the prophetic tradition, can draw upon what Jewish prophets have written, but if we're saying they're universalistic, then why stress the specific fact that they're Jewish prophets? And that they're Jewish prophets, you know? I mean, if what we're saying is that what they say is so wonderful, then why is their Jewishness of any particular concern to us in completely different social situations? And the equal example I was using was Etienne Balibar's example of how the French use the issue of the rights of man. Well, let's say the rights of humankind. Which is the most universal concept possible. But they use it as saying, yeah, French are civilizationally superior to the rest because we came up with this first. And I do find that some uses of the Jewish prophetic falls into the same thing. Some use of the idea that Jews have a specific affinity with justice, I find quite disturbing in some ways. So the other thing was that you're talking about, that unless victimhood is recognized, then it can't be overcome. And you're right, the issue of Palestinians not knowing that they're not recognizing the Nakba and so on and so forth is really important. I don't disagree with that, but my point, I suppose, was, okay, yeah, let's move beyond this now. And Palestinians have also criticized this kind of, just as Jews have criticized the Holocaust narrative, totally controlling kind of like the Jewish imaginary. So Palestinians have also said, look, the Nakba happened, it was a terrible thing, but surely our history and ourselves are more than just a catastrophe that unites us. Surely there's something else that unites us. And these are people saying that, yeah, recognize the catastrophe, recognize victimhood, but move beyond it into a future. So, as you say, it'd be very nice to have Palestinian voices talking about this, talking about the victimization narrative, which I want to stress does not just happen in JFJFP, A, and B, JFJFP does a lot more. B, does not just happen in Jewish groups. C, does not just happen in Palestine solidarity groups. The placing of victimhood on people is, I think, an issue for anyone involved in solidarity. It's not a reason for not being involved in solidarity, but it's a reason for thinking through our solidarity actions. So thanks very much for listening, and look forward to it.
One sentence. This is David's evening. It's David's book. It's David's event. It's great. I would urge you to read the book and to reflect on the issues that David has raised, because they do affect us all in our solidarity work. Thanks very much.